community can make such a difference. I'll just give you one other. In Canada, they've done these studies and found out that all the famous hockey players were born between January and July. Why do you suppose that is? If you're born after July, your chances of becoming a famous hockey player is very, very small. Why would your birth date have anything to do with that? No ice in the ponds, okay. Actually, it has to do with the cutoff date of when they can join these little hockey leagues as little kids. And so if you were born in December, you're competing with, in that year, you're competing with kids that were born in January that are almost a year older than you. And who's going to stand out in a crowd of little kids playing hockey are the little bit bigger, a little bit older kids. And so then they're given, the community gives them more special opportunities. They're put in another little class and they get more practice and so on. And there was a lady in Canada who discovered this. She went to a hockey game with her husband and she was looking at the statistics of all the people playing hockey and she saw this. She said, and her husband hadn't noticed this, and they wrote a book about it, because the whole idea was that when you were born made the difference of whether you were a famous hockey player or not. So if you were born in December, forget it. Don't even try to be a hockey player. The community you grow up in, what the community expectations are for you, makes a huge difference. I'll give you one more. We got time. I thought was really interesting. Airline pilots. The culture that you grow up in makes a really big difference. Airline pilots, a few years ago, Korean Air had a terrible reputation. They had had more airline accidents than any other airlines. And they, there were different places that were started refusing to let Korean Air in their airspace because they just seemed way more dangerous. What they found out was, and they did a study of all these different countries and where accidents happened. Most airline accidents could have been avoided. Did you know that? Most airline crashes, when they actually study them, they find that there were a number of little errors that went wrong. And that if people had noticed them along the way, they could have solved the problem. And what they found out was, in countries where it was very clear authoritarian, you were at different levels and you respected the authority above you, that they had more airline crashes. Why do you suppose that would be? They followed orders, and no one would question the pilot, because who's the top guy in the air, in the cockpit? The pilot. So if he started to do something wrong, the co-pilot or the head engineer, they would listen to these little black boxes after an accident, and they would listen to what the conversation was going on, and they'd find that in cultures, pilots who lived in from cultures that had this real hierarchy kind of authority, and you really respected the higher authority, they didn't question what the pilot did. They would kind of make little, do you think we should do that? Or, looks like we might be. And then they would listen to American pilots, and the co-pilot would say, you know, you need to do this. You forgot to do that. There was not the difference in the hierarchy, because our culture really isn't that way, right? Be a teacher for a while. I do appreciate that some cultures come in and they bow to me when they come to school, and they really respect that authority. But that's not such an American thing, is it? And it's not even that one is good or bad, except in certain kinds of maybe circumstances, like being a pilot. And they actually went back, and Korean Air is now one of the safest airlines, because they figured this out and they trained their people in the cockpit to be okay with, do away with that hierarchy when they're flying. They taught them how to question the pilot and what to do to resolve that problem, and now it's one of the safest airlines in the country, in the world. But, again, it was the community that they grew up in. It was the community that made the difference. So I have several other examples. You've got to read the book Outliers if you haven't. Talks about this quite a bit, the importance of community and how community makes the difference in your success or not. One of the things I think that church and school and home have one of the real benefits of being in a system like we are in is because you have a bigger community. You have church, home, and school that are probably, hopefully, are all striving for the same kind of thing and create the same community. So that's one thing that makes great success in a person's life, a regular person, is the community that they live in. The second one is the opportunities that they're given. And I'll just use one example that was really funny for me a few weeks ago. The opportunities that you've been given as you grow up make a huge difference in the success that you'll have. My daughter and I, Heather, we took a class this summer. I had to take a class at the conference office. Barrett Von Poli, the education superintendent, was teaching this class, and it's about curriculum and how you develop curriculum and so on. And so my daughter wanted to take it too, so it was kind of fun for me because we get to hang out together for a week taking this class. And while we were taking this class, one of the things that they had us do, they divided us into small groups. And the day before, I had tried to second-guess the activity and drew the right popsicle stick and was trying to make it so I'd be in my daughter's group, you know. And so I made sure I got the same color, and then she said, okay, I want one of each color in this group. And one really messed me up. But the next day, she made a mistake. The next day, she said, okay, remember your colors from yesterday. I want you to group in the same color groups. And so Heather and I and Greg Coriel, I think some of you know Greg, used to be the principal at Redwood, the three of us were in one group. And they gave each group a puzzle to do, a 500-piece puzzle. And we knew something was up because she had the groups go to different places. And what she had actually done was she gave each group a different, it was all the same puzzle, but she gave different information. She was talking, her idea was that she was going to show that if you got more help and had more tools that you could do better. So she gave us just a little bag with 500 puzzle pieces. There was no picture, there was no anything. And then she gave another group the bag with a black and white picture, but it was a colored picture puzzle. She gave the third group, I won't say it. I was going to make a joke about PE teachers. I won't. The third group was mostly made up of PE teachers. Okay, I'll say it anyway. And they got the puzzle, and they got the box with it that had the picture on it, so on. And then they gave the fourth group the puzzle, the picture, a big piece of wood to put it on, and they kept going back to that group helping them, right? And then what was supposed to happen was that we got it done. We had different levels of difficulty based on all that. Well, because of opportunities that my daughter and I had been given since we were very little, my dad is a puzzle maker. And so we always had an incomplete puzzle somewhere in our house working on. And so Heather and I and Greg, I think Greg put in two pieces, but anyway, he helped separate the colors, so he was a help. But our group, we finished the puzzle 40 minutes before any other group did. And Barrett kept coming back and looking, and she'd walk away shaking her head because we were kind of blowing her whole theory out of the water. It was supposed to happen just about opposite of how it did with the different groups. But we had kind of a different, interesting discussion at the end of it, because what it made us realize, and actually this book, Outliers, talks about that as well, is that kids that come into my classroom, for example, they come into that classroom with all kinds of different backgrounds and experiences. And their success, a lot of times, is going to be dependent upon the number of opportunities they've had before they even come to my classroom. Things that I've had no control over. But if they come from a family who's read a lot, and there are books, a lot of books around the house all the time, and so on, what are they going to come with? Probably a love for reading and ability to read quite well and so on. Those things, just because of the opportunities that they've been given. One of the studies that they've done shows that kids in the summer from low-income homes, at the end of the school year to when they come back to school in August or September, they actually regress a little bit. Kids from higher-income homes, they don't lose any of that. Now, that sounds almost like, you know, we're not saying that one group is smarter than the other. Do you know what the difference is? many times people that have more money, they give their kids all kinds of opportunities during the summer, right? They go to camp, they go visit museums, they go on trips, they do those kinds of things, and they keep learning throughout the summer, and they don't regress any. Kids that come from situations where the parents are working, they're kind of just left alone all summer to fend for themselves and to whatever they want to do, they do. They tend to regress during that 3 months. That's why in a lot of areas they're trying to do year-round school, because they don't want the regression to take place. Where the bigger the real problem really is that they need to give them, they need to have opportunities. Opportunities make all of the difference. Outliers, the book suggests that really there's no such thing as overnight wonders. People who just instantly become these great successes, they've put in a lot of time and they've been given a lot of opportunities by the community around them. So the opportunities and community kind of go together. Because the community creates opportunities for people. The third one I want to talk about, and this is actually the one I want to spend a little bit of more time with today, because it's the one that I really feel strongly about and I'm worried about, and that is what makes people really greatly successful, just everyday regular people, is creativity. And let me explain what I mean by that. Creativity is the idea of creating something original and useful, right? I mean, to be an original is what we say creativity is about. Creativity requires two different kinds of thinking. There's thinking called divergent thinking, which would be, let me think if I can give an example. If I said, I need to figure out how we can keep the heat a certain temperature in this church. I was at a board meeting a few months ago, and we were talking about how to make the temperature stay a certain way, right? And so divergent thinking would be thinking of all the unique ideas of all the different ways that we could maybe do that. One would be to have electronic windows that open and close. You know, that's an idea, right? One would be to just fix the current one that's there. Well, you know, we had several different ideas. One would be to shut down part of the church and let it be cold on one side and warm on the other. So divergent thinking is to think of all the possibilities. Convergent thinking then is to take all of those and pick the best one and go with it and kind of develop that idea and go with it. Your creative quotient versus your, you know, intelligence quotient, IQ. Did you know that your success depends way more on your CQ than your IQ? That the creativity you bring to something makes a bigger difference. Recently they did a poll with IBM, with a bunch of CEOs from IBM, and they said that their number one leadership competency for the future of people that they wanted to hire in the future was the issue of creativity. They wanted people who could creatively think through a problem and look for solutions. There's a guy named Paul Torrance. He developed a creativity assessment test that he gives people. It turns out that it's a pretty accurate measure of your creativity. And he's been doing this for a number of years, evaluating students around the world on their creativity. And it steadily was on the rise until 1990. And then since 1990, I don't know what happened in 1990, I don't have the answer to that. But since 1990, the creativity scores of this assessment have been on a steady decline. So that means for the last, 20 years, this idea of creativity has been on the decline. Well, that kind of worries me as a teacher, certainly, and as just a member of a church or a member of a community. Why is creativity on the decline for the last 20 years, especially if it's something that's a marker of a regular person being able to be a real success? One of the reasons that they say, and some of the younger ones are going to not like this one. You can probably know what I'm going to say. But one of the reasons that they think creativity is on the downswing is because of the hours spent with television and with video games, because they don't require your brain to work in the same way as when you're in creative activities and creative play. It's kind of done for you. And so it eats up that time that you would creatively play. With watching those things. Even different than reading, because reading you have to create things in your mind and so on. And you know, I like television some, and I do watch television and those kinds of things, but I do know that the more I do that, the less creative I, less time I have to be creative, and the less I am creative. But the other reason that they're thinking it's on the decline is because there's a lack of creativity development in our schools, which is kind of interesting because what it actually has been on the decline as we have pushed more and more for standardized testing. Do you know that? In fact, if you talk to a public school teacher, most of them, their big complaint is that it's taken all the create. They so much have to depend on standardized tests and national testing, and the results of their success or not is based on that they have no time to be creative in the classroom. They just have to teach to the test. And what is really interesting is that I don't know if any of you saw it, but just a few weeks ago, Newsweek, the cover of Newsweek magazine was the creativity crisis in America. And it talks a little bit about this. It's where I'm got some of this information. And it said that what's really interesting is that our country, as other countries are trying to be like us, we're trying to be like what they have been. In other words, many countries like China, Japan, have had a very set standard of things to learn, and it's rote memory, and you sit in rows and you do that. They're heading the direction that we've been, which is that they're realizing that they've missed out because of the lack of the creativity and the spontaneity and the teaching that, and they're heading the direction that we have been, and what are we doing? They're kind of the professor that tells the story says he got up and he was in China and they'd asked him a question, what's the direction and the focus that education in America is going, and he talked about standardization of testing and standardization of curriculum and so on, and they started laughing and they go, what's so funny? He says, well, you're heading towards where we were, and we're heading as fast as we can to where we think you have been in the past. It's kind of interesting. We're kind of heading opposite directions again. One of the things about creativity that's kind of unfortunate is that we've always thought creativity is just for the arts. You know, it's for music, it's for art. But the truth of the matter is creativity is in everything. When I sit in these meetings and somebody says, how do we fix this thing? And Bob Fenzel goes, well, I could do this and this and this. That's, you know, problem solving is creative thinking. It doesn't mean that you can paint a picture or not. Bob, maybe you can paint a picture too. I don't know. Oh, Paulette says yes. Okay, so you're an artist. But problem solving is across the board. You know, being able to creatively come up with solutions has nothing to do with just being in the fine arts or in music or that sort of thing. It should permeate everything. One of the reasons I think in our schools, and we'll talk about church in a minute, but one of the things I think in our schools that has been the fear of creativity is that we lose sight of that we've got to know all the concrete facts and that sort of thing, and that we want to emphasize that. The truth of the matter is that true creativity is not free from finding the facts and having all the information, because that's where it starts. In fact, the way this article said is that creativity isn't freedom from concrete facts. Fact-finding and deep research are vital stages in the creative process. You have to have information to base the choices that you make and the solutions that you come up with. Let me ask you a question, and if you want to respond to this, it's okay with me. Can creativity be taught? I have students that come into my art class many times at Redwood, and they'll go, I can't draw. I don't know how to, you know, I can't, I'm not creative. And I'll say, great, then this is the class for you, because if you could already draw, you wouldn't need this class, you know? They hate that, but the idea is, can creativity be taught? Most of you would say yes. The research says yes. The research says that your brain is almost like a muscle. Sounds terrible, but your brain is kind of like a muscle. If you use it, you can develop it more, right? So yes, it's true that there are some people that are more bent to being able to play basketball than others. There's some people that might be more bent to be creative than others. But the truth of the matter is if you stretch your creativity and you push yourself in the area of creativity, and other people do, you can learn to be more creative. So if you just think you're not creative, not true. You just maybe haven't stretched that part of your brain yet. So how do we teach creativity? What are the best ways to teach creativity? Practice. You've got to be put in the situations where you need to use it. Let me tell you one that we've been working at Redwood the last couple of years. We're trying to use more and more as we can, a problem-solving approach to teaching. Because if you present problems and don't give the solution, what does the student have to do? Has to figure it out. And in the past, I think sometimes we're so quick, we want to give people answers. And so we give them the answer quick, and we don't let them. My daughter calls it, she does a whole thing in a unit when she first starts teaching a class on the concept of discovering things and discovery, and how much better it is to discover something than just to be told it and handed it to. Because you don't remember it and learn it. You don't go through the process of creativity like you do when you discover it for yourself. So problem solving is a big one. Looking for all the possibilities. How many of you were here a few weeks ago when I talked about smart people doing dumb things? Okay, quite a few of you. Do you remember that thing I put up with the three people? Some of you are still asking me questions about that one. About is a married person looking at an unmarried person, remember? And what we said was that most of you said C, there's not enough information. Whereas the truth of the matter, the answer was A, because there were only two possibilities, and if you plugged them both in, you found out that A was the right answer. And the problem that we don't do is we don't teach people to look at all the possibilities. That's part of creativity, is to look at all the angles of the same question, right? So if we teach people to look for all the possibilities in finding an answer or finding a solution, we're teaching them to think creatively. Allow questions, questions, questions. Allow lots of questions, and don't give answers, answers, answers. Is what they tell us in teaching now. Encourage uniqueness. Be responsive to a person's needs, but challenge them to think. Did you know that some hardship is actually a good thing? Because it teaches you to be flexible, and flexibility goes hand in hand with creativity. If you role play a lot, if you teach your kids to role play, or you role play situations, that really develops creativity. If you require someone to voice somebody else's opinion, one of the things I love to do in a class is to ask kids to go to two sides depending on what they believe on something, and then I tell them that they have to come up with the opposite person's view. Because that's not what they think you're going to do, right? Okay, if you believe this, go here. Now I want you to defend them, and I want them to defend you. And to have to look at the other person's perspective, what does that force you to do? It requires you to really think and be creative. People who have creativity and are successful, they see failure as a new opportunity, which is not how we normally look at failure. Hey, let me try something else, and that's really, you know, my brothers are great at that with a computer. I'm ready to throw it through the window when it doesn't work. And I'll sit there, I'm amazed. My brother will come over and says, well, did you try this? Or, oh, that doesn't work. And by the third thing, you know, I'm ready to be done already. Let's go buy a new computer. And they go, no way, you know, we could try. And they'll try 10 different things, and they'll find the reason that something's wrong, and they'll fix it. Because they keep looking at, well, what about this possibility? What about that possibility? Did you know that exploring other cultures makes you more creative? And the studies that they've done have shown that not even if you even just visit the other culture, that's great, but even if you just read about another culture and learn about that culture, it makes you more creative. Why do you think that's true? There's more possibilities than just the world you live in, right? It lets you know that there are bigger pictures. There's other ways of living than just the way that you live. Did you know that physical exercise helps creativity? If you're in a block, you know, go out and do some jumping jacks for a while. Go for a walk. They say that you have to be kind of physically fit, or that doesn't work. If you come back exhausted, you can't think creatively either. So you have to have a certain level of physical fitness first. But if you go out and you are a little bit active, if you get kind of block on something, you go out and be active, you come back, you can think better. One thing that they're finding out, they're suggesting that if you have a passion about something, follow it. You know that the most successful people are the ones who don't necessarily work hard on the things they can't do. They develop the things they can do. There's a whole book out right now just on that topic of developing what you're good at, because that's what the most successful people do. They develop what you're good at. So you follow a passion. Also, as I talked about reading earlier, if there's a lot of books in your home, creativity is contagious. So if you want to be creative, be, you know, hang around creative people, because it kind of is a contagious thing. And then last one I wanted to point out was that open-ended questions are okay. We like answers a lot of the times, but it's not bad to have open-ended questions that there isn't one answer to. It makes you be creative. It makes you think it through. Now, so far this hasn't sounded like a real spiritual topic, maybe. So here's the question. Let me read one thing to you first, and then I'll ask you this question. This is from an advertisement from an IB. This is an IBM advertisement. Dreamers, heretics, gadflies, mavericks, and geniuses. This headline from an IBM advertisement caught my eye. Organizations, businesses, and church have always had a difficult time making room for creative, independent thinkers. How does IBM, the model of the modern corporate structure, relate to such people? The ad went on to explain this. The story goes that Henry Ford once hired an efficiency expert to evaluate his company. After a few weeks, the expert made his report. It was highly favorable except for one thing. "It's that man down the hall," said the expert. "Every time I go by his office, he's just sitting there with his feet up on his desk. He's wasting your money." That man, replied Mr. Ford, "once had an idea that saved us millions of dollars. At the time, I believe his feet were planted right where they are now." The ad continued, "At IBM, we have 46 people like that, and we don't worry about where they put their feet. They are the IBM fellows." They actually have a term for a group that works for IBM. "They earned the title by having ideas that made a difference. Their job is to have more ideas like that, but under a very special condition. It's called freedom. Freedom from deadlines, freedom from committees, freedom from the usual limits of corporate approval. For a term of at least 5 years, an IBM fellow is free to pursue any advanced project of value to IBM, even if chances for success may seem remote. As a result, some of the great innovations of our time have come from IBM fellows. We may not always understand what they're doing, much less how they do it, but we do know this: the best way to inspire an IBM fellow is to get out of the way." I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, let me ask you the question that this kind of relates to. What does this idea, particularly of creativity, have to do with the success of a church or church life? Why should this be important to us? Is there room for that in the church? Yes? Get out of the way. Yeah. Can we freely ask questions? Is it good that our kids ask questions? Is it good that we ask questions? Are we very good at tolerating unconventional answers? Should we be? Maybe we should be. Do we allow for discovery in our church, or do we mostly hand out answers? I think sometimes we hand out answers too quickly. It was amazing to me to read a history of our church and find out that James White never accepted the Trinity his entire life. He died not believing in the Trinity. And nobody kicked him out of church, because it was kind of a process, you know. It seemed like they were excited about and learning and growing, and that it was okay to question things and to wonder and not be sure about different things. That's kind of heartening to me that we have that history, because I think maybe sometimes the problem that we have is that we're too afraid to let people come to different conclusions, or that they can raise questions that we can ask. We still need to have that feeling of discovery, don't we? If our kids don't have that sense of discovery and that they've got to learn it for themselves and it's okay to question it, I think we're going to lose them, because they have to go through that same process just like our forefathers did and just like maybe we did. Is there room for creativity in doctrine? Is there more than one way to interpret something? Maybe. Can we find ways to support structure, guidelines that any organization needs, including our church? Can we support that and yet have room for challenging ideas or independent thought? Can we encourage dreamers and maybe even mavericks in our church, people that don't see everything exactly the same way as other people do? I hope so. I think that's what kind of makes a difference. Barbara.
We have to be able to do that, otherwise Christ wouldn't be able to be our Savior.
perfect segue into what I was going to just say here, and that was Jesus creative? Was Jesus a creative problem solver when he was on this earth? One of the things most interesting to me about Jesus when you read his life is that he usually answered questions with another question. He didn't hand people the answer. You know, we were talking in Sabbath school this morning about his parables and about how some of his parables are left really open-ended. They can be interpreted so many different ways, and that some of his parables are, he doesn't just give you the answer. You have to really think about what was the point of that parable. We talked about one that maybe we would think of as a normal one that it's obvious, like the prodigal son, he comes home. But we were talking today about all the other kinds of things that maybe we could get out of that parable. Do I see myself as the father who maybe forgets to appreciate the son who stays home? Somebody else brought that up today. I'm like, wow, I'd never looked at it from that perspective. If the father had had the right relationship with the older son, maybe he wouldn't have been so upset when the younger son came back. You know, and maybe it wasn't just the older son's fault that there wasn't that relationship. Maybe the father had not done something there as well. So, I mean, there's so many ways to look at the parables and see different things. I think Jesus purposely left a lot of those things open-ended. It's not comfortable because we like answers, don't we? We like to kind of be, it's easier sometimes to be told what the answer is. Was Jesus a creative Sabbath keeper? Certainly for his time, he was a very creative Sabbath keeper. He didn't keep it the way a lot of people thought he should. He seemed to have room for the creative. In fact, it seems to me like he chose people that could do that, could think outside the box. Think of his disciples. You know, Peter, when he has the vision and he has to go to Cornelius' house, was that outside the box for him? Was that a brand new idea that he was supposed to take this to somebody else whose home he would normally not even walk into? Peter had to be willing to think outside the box. He had to be willing to, and sometimes it seems like Jesus maybe takes us there kicking and screaming, you know, kind of gives us a little kick and forces us to think outside the box. I have to close, but the point I'd kind of like to end with, I said I was going to tell you about four different things that I think really make a successful person. I've only told you three: community, opportunities, creativity, and there's probably a whole bunch more. That's in my 18-part series still to come. But I left one out, and that was the text that I put in your bulletins. And I love the way the Message Bible puts it. And he was talking about David, but he says this: he's a man whose heart beats to my heart, a man who will do what I tell him. I just love that phrase, he's a man whose heart beats to my heart. You know, they were so in sync. It's become one of my favorite texts, and I think that probably most of us here are just regular people, right? Right? Okay. Okay, there might be a few smart ones, but we're just regular people. But I think if we remember that text, we can accomplish amazing things if our heart beats to his heart. How can we not accomplish amazing things? Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for the creativity you've given each one of us and for giving us minds that you want us to use and to think. And forgive us when maybe we balk at that and you have to kick us a little and get our creative minds going. Help us to realize that that our spiritual lives and the future of our church are probably dependent upon that ability to do that. We thank you for the example Jesus gave us of being creative and how he approached and looked at life. And we ask that we can have a little bit of that as well. And most importantly, help us to be able to say, or you to be able to say about us, that our heart beats to your heart. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.